Our first scripture reading for this morning comes from Paul's letter to the Philippians. It's printed in your bulletin on one of the inside flaps. When we remember God's radical love for us, it's not hard to imagine how we might eagerly take up the call that God has given us in Jesus Christ, a call to live our lives together for each other's good. Now, Paul writes these words to the church at Philippi to strengthen them, to encourage them. This is a community that he has loved and loved well, but even so, they seem to be disheartened. Paul has been in jail, and it's almost as if that distance has caused a disconnect for them with their very faith. In Paul's resolve, it's almost as if he's saying, you could stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. I'm going to stand my ground, won't be turned around, and I'll keep this world from dragging me down. I'm going to stand my ground, and I won't back down. Christine sang that in the first service. It was way better, but you don't want that. When love calls us, we don't back down. The sufferings of the journey, whatever they may be, were endured by Christ, and even those sufferings draw us closer to the one who gives us life. Join me as we read responsively from your bulletin. Paul writes, if anyone else has reason to put their confidence in physical advantages, I have even more. I was circumcised on the eighth day. I am from the people of Israel and the tribe of Benjamin. I am a Hebrew of the Hebrews. With respect to observing the law, I'm a Pharisee. With respect to devotion to the faith, I harass the church. With respect to righteousness under the law, I'm blameless. These things were my assets, but I wrote them off as a loss for the sake of Christ. I've lost everything for him. But what I lost, I think of as trash, so that I might gain Christ and be found in him. It is the righteousness of God that is based on faith. It includes being conformed to his death so that I may perhaps reach the goal of the resurrection of the dead. Brothers and sisters, I myself don't think I've reached it, but I do this one thing. I forget about the things behind me and reach out for the things ahead of me. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. This morning we continue in our journey through the book of Exodus. I love these weeks where we can really get into the narrative. Each Sunday, I just move the ribbon in my Bible a little bit further, and we jump ahead in the story. This morning, I'm indebted to John Allen for his liberating interpretation of the Ten Commandments. We have been following the Israelites out of the land of Egypt, now into the wilderness, and today we meet them at Mount Sinai. Reading from Exodus chapter 20, beginning in verse 1. Then God spoke all these words. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself an idol, whether in the form of anything that is in heaven above, or that is on the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not make wrongful use of the name of the Lord your God, for the Lord will not acquit anyone who misuses his name. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. Honor your father and your mother, so that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or male or female slave, or ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. When all God's people witness the thunder and lightning, the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, they were afraid. They were afraid and they trembled and they stood at a distance and they said to Moses, "You speak to us and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us or we will die." Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. For God has come only to test you and to put the fear of him upon you so that you do not sin." By this point in the journey, we know that Pharaoh has figured out what it takes to keep a people down. It's fear. Moses organizes the Israelites, and Pharaoh responds by telling his overseers, "Make them work harder. Let heavier work be laid on the Israelites, then they will labor at it and pay no attention to deceptive words." What do you know? It works. The next time Moses goes to speak with his people, they can't listen to him because their spirit is broken. They're tired. They have no capacity to imagine God's promise to them because they're too afraid. The wind had been knocked out of their sails one too many times. They were just plain out of breath. That really gets to the heart of Israel's predicament in slavery. They can't be free from fear unless they catch God's new vision for them. They can't catch God's new vision for them when they're tired and afraid. So what's a God to do? Get them the heck out of Egypt. Break the cycle of fear. It's dramatic. It's decisive. It is bold on God's part. But in driving the Israelites out into the wilderness, though, God is able to do what God does best. God is able to shape and mold a people who are truly free. Free from slavery, free from Pharaoh, free from fear. It's then, and only then, that the Israelites have the capacity to live the kind of life together God intends, a life of love in community, with mutual care and responsibility to God, responsibility for one another. But of course, here's the thing. When you've been afraid for so long, you don't immediately realize that you're free. As we've gotten a glimpse into the Israelites' wilderness journey through the lectionary over the past few weeks, it's not terribly difficult to see how fear has really been an undercurrent beneath the spirit that is buoying them along. There's not exactly a clear sense of direction. The Israelites complained bitterly, "It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die here in the desert." There's not enough food. The Israelites complained bitterly. "If only we had died at the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when at least we sat by flesh pots and had bread to eat." For you've brought us out into the wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. God has God's work cut out for her, huh? Now, God knows that the Israelites' habits of slavery, really their habits of fear, they have to be disrupted if they are ever truly going to make it out of the land of Egypt. God promises them manna, and when manna isn't enough to satisfy them, God sends in the quails. Never again will they fear going to bed hungry. God provides an extra portion of manna on the Sabbath. Never again will the Israelites fear being worked to the bone, of becoming so breathless in their work that the spirit of life can't blow through them. God encourages Moses to share leadership so that the Israelites don't have to fear the tyranny of a Pharaoh again. Well, that's when they reach Sinai, the mount where today's reading takes place. At Sinai, God gives the gift of the law, or as we call it in Worship and Wonder, I love this, the 10 best ways to live. The 10 best ways to live. God starts off by reminding the Israelites of who they are, by reminding them of who God is. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt. Now, the commands that follow are what truly set God's people free. You shall have no other gods before me. This first commandment really lays the foundation for the freedom God desires for humanity. We are to live free in our lives as ones who are formed in God's image. Think about what a radical reorientation from slavery that is. In slavery, you start to take on the shape and form of your master. With God, you are free to emulate the love that is God. Now, this commandment frees the Israelites, frees us from revering anything other than God. Our identity as children of God, our responsibility to do justice, love kindness, walk humbly to love our neighbors as ourselves, these take priority over any other demands. We don't have to bear the burden of choosing between the world's competing demands, which are inevitably death-dealing. We are free. We are free to devote ourselves to God alone. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. What would it be like if we really and truly were able to free ourselves from the expectation that if we can just work hard enough, we can work our way into being loved, into being valued, and into feeling like we're really worth something. Our work does not define us. And when we rest, we have time to catch our breath and to revel in the God who created us, the God who, in fact, rested himself. See the seventh day of creation. Then there's honoring our parents, the you shall nots, no murdering, no stealing, no lying, no adultery, no jealousy. We're free to be in right relationship with each other. So if in giving us these commandments, God is freeing us from fear, what are we being freed for? First, I think we're being freed to heal the hurts of the world. That seems like a pretty tall order, I know. Just look at the past few weeks, Houston, Florida, Puerto Rico. God, that was before Las Vegas. Your breath just almost catches to say it. We can't heal every hurt. We can't. Only God can do that. But as Glennon Doyle Melton suggests in her most recent book, Love Warrior, maybe instead of slamming the door on pain, we need to throw the door wide open and say, come in, sit with me, and don't leave until you've taught me what I need to know. We can do that. We can be brave enough to do that. And we can sit with pain for a while and we can learn from it, but we don't have to carry it on our own. We don't have to become so consumed by it that we're just gorging ourselves on all of the pain that we hear about and experience in the world. But we don't have to carry it on our own. That's not our job. That's God's. But being freed to heal the hurts of the world does allow us to do something. It allows us to use our voices for good. It allows us to connect across ideologies, to advocate for change, to respond in compassion. And when we do that, we set other people free too. And being freed to heal the hurts of the world requires something of us, though it requires that we listen, that we really listen to each other, that we don't just hear with our heads, but that we listen with our hearts. That we start our conversations with each other by giving the other the benefit of the doubt. That we enter into conversations in a posture of humility. That we might expect to understand, even if we don't agree. Secondly, we're being freed to live confidently in our generosity. I know we're talking about our general fund campaign this month, but what we're really talking about isn't just money. It's ministry. It's mission. When we can release our fear of giving too much, if we give too much, that then there's not going to be enough for us. If we can release that fear, our hands are open enough that we can grasp onto something that is of infinite worth. That's hope. Our generosity is someone else's hope. And third, not finally, this is certainly not an exhaustive list, but we are being freed to love boldly. God's love for this world encompasses more than we could ever hold in our hearts. And because we are created in the image of that loving God, we know that our own capacity for love is limitless. When we seek to share even a fraction of that love boldly, we risk something. We risk that love is going to be rejected, and that's going to feel a whole lot like we ourselves are being rejected, and that is going to be painful. Glennon Doyle Melton has something to say about this too. She writes, "We think that our job as human beings is to avoid pain. Our job as parents is to protect our children from pain. Our job as friends is to fix each other's pain." She writes, "Maybe that's why we all feel like failures so often, because we all have the wrong job description for love. Loving boldly is inherently risky, and yet it's the only thing that really has the capacity to save the world. See Jesus of Nazareth." In the face of natural disasters and of human ones, we have a choice. We have a choice. We can choose fear, or we can choose healing and hope. We can choose confident generosity. We can choose bold love. After Kurt Cobain's violent death, Nirvana's drummer, Dave Grohl, was paralyzed with grief and fear. He didn't know how he was going to go on. He didn't know if it was worth it to keep playing the drums. His career was up in the air. It was hard to make sense of really why any of it mattered anymore. One night he got a call from one of his managers. His manager said, you know, Tom Petty just called me and he wondered if you would play with him and the Heartbreakers on Saturday Night Live this week. Their drummer had just quit. Dave credits that call for breaking that paralysis of anger and grief, fear and uncertainty about what was next. It was the first time, he says, that he looked forward to doing what he loved to do again. Now, he tells the story with a lot more expletives, but you get the idea. We know that fear can control our lives. We know that. We've lived that. What we can never fully know is how our choice to live generously and to love boldly can offer someone else healing and hope.